Let's begin to look at this then, Lecture 8, the Pastor's Visiting. We're a wee bit behind the clock, but not too worried about it. If necessary, I'll give you the last lecture or even two, just full, you can read it yourselves. So, we're looking at visiting after having looked at preaching, and we're asking the question, first of all, why visit? Why visit? And then we go on to the question, who to visit, then we'll get to how to visit, and so on. So first of all, why visit? The first answer is, a home-going pastor makes a church-going people. I think it's a fairly well-established fact. A home-going pastor makes a church-going people. I gave you a quote there about Dr. Howard Sugden of Jackson, Michigan, who averaged 1,500 visits a year, which is, to me, just impossible, but I believe it. I wouldn't tend to measure it so much by numbers, unless you're in huge congregations. This pastor here, who is at 24, L.B. Glynn, talks about the difficulty he had in reaching 1,000. I probably had difficulty reaching 300-400, but everyone has their limits. One of my predecessors in Stornoway, Kenneth McRae, he has a diary which I'd really recommend reading, although it's a bit repetitive at points. He records doing things like 20 and 30 visits a day, and he was ministering in a congregation of over 1,000 souls, and it was the only way he could get round everybody. So there's obviously not an awful lot of spiritual benefit often in these visits, you would imagine, but at least he's making an appearance. You have to make your decision. Are you going to make sure you get around everyone in a year in a cursory way, maybe, or else are you going to take a more substantial approach to visiting and just explain to people you'll manage around 2-3 years, once every 2 or 3 years, something like that. Second reason why visiting enhances preaching. I put a number of quotes there to argue this case. You'll see in the bold, in the first quote, the clergyman is liable to be deficient upon one or the other side of this double character. That's a preacher or a pastor. He is a better preacher than he is a pastor, or else a better pastor than he is a preacher. It should therefore be the aim of the clergyman to perfect himself in both respects. This is Shedd speaking. And he goes on to argue that really it's an error to try and make these two offices independent. That you cannot really become good at one without the other. And so in the third quote there he says, instead therefore of regarding the functions of the preacher and the pastor as totally independent of each other, and capable of being carried to perfection each by itself, the clergyman must perform them both and with equal fidelity. And then he explains in the next quote from page 352 that this sort of regular visitation of a congregation will fill the mind of the clergyman with subjects for sermons, with plans and methods of treating them, and with trains of reflection. Nothing so kindles and enriches the orator's mind as living intercourse with individual persons. And then in number 20 there, from Derek Prime, I totally agree with him here. The functions of the shepherd are more likely to be neglected than those of the teacher. I'm sure we do know the odd pastor who just spends his time visiting. He's a very sociable kind of gregarious chap who loves old ladies and things like that, but they're very rare. You might get 1 in 50 or 1 in 100. It's far more common to err on being the teacher than being the pastor, and there in that quote Prime goes on to explain why this can often be the case. Teaching responsibilities, he says, can be much more readily defined. They can be much more easily limited, whereas in pastoral work, it's hard to define and it's hard to limit. It's also less consistent from one week to another. And yet he goes on to argue again for the need for visiting because it enhances preaching. I certainly have lost count of the number of sermons I got or texts that became the basis of sermons from visiting people from week to week. One, three. Why visit? Because it's a means of grace. It's a means of grace. Again, Shed says in that bold part of that quote, "There is nothing better adapted to develop piety, to elicit the latent principles of the Christian, than going from house to house and conversing with varieties of character and all grades of intelligence upon the subject of religion." Perhaps a bit overstated, nothing better adapted to develop piety, but it is a huge help to the development of spirituality and godliness. And he says there, "The clergyman then will grow in grace by simple assiduity in the discharge of this part of his professional labours." And he goes on to give examples towards the end of that quote, how he says, "Let him stand with the same uniform fidelity at the bedside of the dying Christian, dispelling momentary gloom by the exhibition of Christ and his atonement, supplicating for more of the comfort of the Holy Ghost in the soul of the dying saint, listening to the utterances of serene faith or of rapturous triumph. Let him submit his own soul to the great variety of influences that come off from the experience of the sick and the dying, and he will greatly deepen and strengthen his own religious character." And this is why your internships and your mentoring relationships with your own local pastors are so important, that you should really, these are theoretical lectures, but you really need to give a high priority to the actual practice of these things, to really experience the truth of them. There again, Shed says, "The clergyman needs not to go up and down the earth seeking for instrumentalities for personal improvement. By his very position and daily labour, he may be made spiritual and heavenly." And again, I think we can know people, or we can remember people, or we maybe presently know people whose preaching, or even their character, would be massively improved by more regular connection with people in their congregations who are really suffering, who are really in need. And I think sometimes it can become quite clear where a sermon is a purely a study sermon, and it's not grown out of or in relationship to the contact with people and their daily needs. So it's a means of grace. Number three, it is a powerful role model. It's a powerful role model. R.C. Anderson says, "A rationalization given by some local churches that do not engage in evangelism comes from the pastor's study. Its lyrics are as follows. Don't expect me to be involved in evangelism. I am the pastor teacher and am responsible only for edifying the saints. Timothy must have been caught up in the syndrome. For though church leaders all around him were evangelizing on a regular basis, it was necessary for Paul to tell Timothy, do the work of an evangelist." It's interesting to note that there was not even a bit of discussion as to whether or not Timothy was equipped for the task, or whether evangelizing was designated to him under the division of labour spelled out in Ephesians 4:11. In his pastoral position, he was merely expected to do it. Why? Because the pastor is the most visible role model a congregation has. If he expects other people to do as he says, he must build an atmosphere of credibility by agreeing to do personally what he tells other people they should do. It's all very well to get frustrated in ministry, you know, when people are not witnessing and people are not reaching out, but they might simply be following our example. Then 1:5, non-visitation was Jonathan Edwards' biggest mistake. Non-visitation was Jonathan Edwards' biggest mistake. Ian Murray says, Edwards' 13 hours in study were by no means always spent alone. Hopkins makes it clear that Edwards was readily accessible, not only to his family, but also to all in his large congregation who had any spiritual need. One reason why he did not visit from house to house, says Hopkins, was he believed he could do more good conversing with persons under religious concern, that should say, in the study, and where they might be sure to be allowed easy access to him, and where they were treated with all desirable kindness, tenderness and familiarity. So Ian Murray's basically saying here, Edwards Mans was very open. You know, he frequently had people with him, sometimes thronged with people. So that's good. However, Edwards became separated from his people. You'll see at the top of that next quote, in bold, one failure in particular on his part has been persistently mentioned by later writers. During Edwards' 23 years at Northampton, given the practice already mentioned not to visit his people in their own houses unless he was sent for by the sick, it was inevitable that he should appear more remote and more absorbed in study than is usual among parish ministers. In the eyes of some, he dwelt apart, as though he had no time for the common everyday interests of his people. This certainly lent itself at the time of the communion controversy to the charge that he was stiff and unsociable. And Hopkins, though he draws attention to this element of Edwards' ministry, he's not being critical, he's just simply saying, here are the facts, this is what happened. And he's saying, it's not that Edwards had a lack of interest in the people either. He really believed, he was acting for their good. He really believed that this was the best way he could show compassion and love to them, in the light, as Hopkins says, of his own gifts and circumstances. You can read the rest of that yourself. I think it's a fascinating commentary, really, on Edwards' ministry. Sometimes the focus in a controversy, you know, can be on the theology, whereas actually there's another issue going on. And this is really suggesting that, although obviously there was a theological issue in the Edwards controversy, that there was maybe a practical issue as well that was feeding it or magnifying it, or it really was the real issue, and yeah, easier to take on the theological matter. So again, it's about perception. It's not so much, you know, I can say before God, you know, Lord, you know, I love these people and I love, you know, I'd meet with them 13 hours a day in my study, but it's how is that perceived? That might well be what's going through our minds, but what's going through other people's minds as they watch that and don't have the opportunity to read our minds and hearts. So, moving on to number 2 then, who to visit. So, giving you some reasons why to visit. They're not exhaustive, of course. But now, who to visit? 2:1, begin with your own congregation. Pretty obvious, really. Your own church is a good place to start, and it's to start at the beginning when you're less likely to already be involved in community activities and less likely to be involved in large church projects, as R.C. Anderson suggests here. So he says if he's called to a small or medium-sized church, he can set as a primary goal the visitation of every home unit represented in his congregation. Making such visits is a higher priority at this point than any program he may wish to initiate. So he's basically saying, do nothing, apart from preach, until you've visited everyone in your congregation. I think that's really good advice. And I would suggest to you that you do it briefly and with an elder. That you don't just go in, you know, here's the newbie to strange homes, strange people you've never met before, and you know that's really not a great way to begin social connection with people. It can create a lot of awkwardness and embarrassment. It's also extremely draining on you if you're going to do that for the first month or two of your ministry. Whereas if you go with an elder, maybe the elder of that district, if you do that kind of thing, you know, there's already a connection there. When you run out of conversation and they run out of conversation, the elder's there to, you know, really keep things going. And it's really sociable to begin with, or social, I should say. It's not so much, you know, we're immediately trying to, you know, are you saved, are you unsaved, you know, what's your problems? You're really just introducing yourself. I would suggest you're looking at no more than 20 minutes, 30 at the most. Try and get round in an evening of a few hours, you know, 6 to 10 houses. You make clear to people this is not your normal pattern of visiting. You'll get round to the longer visit, but you're just going round introducing yourself. The briefer you can do it, the better, really. And that saves you being under pressure. If you can do that within the first month or two or three, then obviously you can then take a little bit longer to get round people for proper visits. If you say, well, I'm going to do my, you know, 1 hour, 1.5 hour visit to begin with, then if it's a reasonably sized congregation, you're going to be 6 months, 9 months, maybe even a year before you meet some of the people in your congregation, which really, that distance and silence can be fertile ground for Satan to sow discord. And so I just suggest, begin with your own congregation, begin briefly, begin with an elder, and just get that done. And then it takes a bit of the pressure off you. You can start your more systematic usual visitation. 2.2, but do not stop with your own congregation. We're moving out here. It's a matter of prioritising. Andrew Bonar says, it will take all 1857 to know the faces and the way of the people of my district. Until I thus know them, I can scarcely expect to see many of them come to church. Isn't that an interesting comment? He's talking here not about the people in his church, but the people in his district. And he's saying, until I can actually get round their homes, introduce myself, say hello, welcome them to the church, make them know they're very warmly invited. And he's saying, I can't really expect them to come. And Bonar has an amazing ability at remembering people's faces. Soon after we read there, coming to Glasgow, he spoke to a little girl in the street, calling her by name. The child ran home to her mother, calling out delightedly, "Mither, mither, he kens me." Translate, Ian. Thank you. If one of the congregation were out of place on Sabbath, the minister's eye at once noted the vacant seat, and the minister himself was sure to appear at his door during the week to ask for the cause of his absence. He was everybody's friend. Now, I think this is good, and yet there's a danger here in terms of noticing absence in a congregation. If it's small, obviously, you hardly need more than a cursory look. You know there's somebody missing. And yet there are some pastors who, you know, they'll come into the pulpit and, you know, they'll sit down so that they're almost invisible. But before this is in Scotland anyway, you know, before the first psalm is sung, you start seeing, you know, looking around. And then maybe during the singing, they're doing this as well. You know, it's well motivated. They're looking for the missing sheep, I think. But, you know, it's very distracting, and it looks more nosy than pastoral, I think, at times. So somehow develop an ability to pick up these cues without making it really obvious that you're doing so. Visit the afflicted and the bereaved. So your own congregation, moving out, the afflicted and bereaved. And again, Taylor and Plummer say, begin this work as your pastorate begins. He says, if you cannot fully master your pulpit preparations at first so as to secure the time needful for systematic visitation, yet never omit the care of the sick and the afflicted. You know, whatever else we're in this world to do, we're in this world to do this. It is far more important than honing the sermon. And as I have found, and every pastor in the world, I reckon, has found out at some time, to their cost, even a day's delay sometimes can be literally fatal. You know, if someone goes into hospital and you get the message that, you know, it's not just they've broken their leg or whatever, but there's something serious, and you say, well, my next 2 days are packed out, I'll go on Friday or something like that. Friday may not come for that person. And it's extremely difficult to explain to the family why you weren't there. And I'm not saying, you know, as soon as the call comes, you go, either. But there's somewhere in there that is a wise place to be. Plummer, is it Plummer? Yeah, Taylor and Plummer say, this visitation will mellow and fatten the roots of your own character. It will feed your public prayers. It will furnish many themes and suggestions for your pulpit teachings. It will cheer you on in a thousand ways in your arduous exertions. And as the years revolve, you will come to be regarded almost as a member of every family and be rewarded by the confidence and affection of the flock as a whole. On that you may always rest as securely as the swimmer does upon the wave, and your character among your people will add an irresistible ingredient to the eloquence of your speech. And, you know, I'd really like you to, if you take any quote out of this lecture, take that one and just ever remind yourself of that week by week in the pastorate. You may think, you know, they need another commentary consulted to help your sermon, but actually, you know, what might make all the difference in the power of your sermon is a pastoral visitation. And it's developed, people talk as well. You're not doing visitation to make people say, oh, the minister's a great visitor, or, you know, he's always out and about. We're not doing it for that, but they will say these things, and people really appreciate it. They love it. It's rare. And so when their pastor is a visiting pastor, people just love it. And other congregations have people who get very jealous as well. And maybe put pressure on their own pastor to get his act together. So I'm visiting the afflicted and the bereaved. Again there, this is from Prime. He says, the sooner a first visit can be made, the better, once we are aware of someone's hospitalisation. Besides reassuring to the patient and an evidence of the immediacy of our caring, it means that we are never caught unawares by sudden deterioration or serious illness. It happened to me twice. And in one case, my relationship with the family never recovered. In the one case, it was because the deacon who communicated the hospitalisation of the person did not give any indication of the seriousness. The person had been in and out of hospital many times over the years, and there was no indication that this was any different. And yet the person was dead within 24 hours, and I had not visited. And I was asked to take the funeral, but I never really recovered with that family. And the other instance was actually forgetfulness more than anything. I was told this person had gone into hospital, I'd gone out visiting, I hadn't written down the name, to visit, and so I actually even I passed the place I should have visited, got home, next morning the husband had passed away. And I mean, it was a godly Christian woman who had a good relationship with. Unfortunately, the husband was not converted. And she is very understanding and very forgiving, but boy, do you feel miserable about it, you know. So, just really watch out for that. Then there's a number of really helpful bullet points there from Derek Prime on hospital visitation. I'd really encourage you to take these to heart. It may be slightly different in this culture, but I think there are general principles here that are extremely helpful. The first one is, you know, most cases pastors are allowed to visit outside normal visiting hours, but don't abuse that privilege. And if you are going outside normal visiting hours, always check at the desk, the main desk, is it an appropriate time to visit? Is it okay to go into the ward and visit such and such a person? There may be some procedure going on or something else going on in the ward where they just say, well, could you wait 20 minutes or 30 minutes? Just always just communicate. You regard this as a privilege and you're treating it as such, and you're respecting the fact that there are other people doing, you know, extremely important jobs there that you want to cooperate with. And again, when leaving, go to the people who gave you, you know, directions or whatever, and just thank them. Always build up, really try and build up relationships with these nurses in the wards. They really are the gatekeepers. And they'll be extremely helpful to you, usually, unless you abuse them or, you know, treat them as skivvies. Skivvies? No. Yeah, help me out. I think it's people who used to clean the steps with of the tenements in Glasgow during, you know, times when very poor times. And anyway, you get the point. Poor people. Yeah, it's better to make frequent visits of 2 or 3 minutes than a lengthy visit that wearies and embarrasses. I think that's a very common mistake for ministers to make, staying 20 and 30 minutes and more at a person's bedside, unless they're really on the road to recovery. And even then, people are usually exhausted in hospital. They've hardly been able to sleep. And really, you're looking at 10 minutes or so, and most people will not view that as rude. And, you know, if they're really keen for you to stay, then, you know, they'll make you stay, but on the whole, keep it short and be more frequent than long. And yeah, always ask to pray. If possible, read the Bible with them. Be sensitive to people in the ward around about you. I know there are some ministers who say, you know, this is a great opportunity to witness to people in the rest of the ward if it's a multi-person ward. So that, you know, they'll pray at the top of their voices and they'll read the Bible at the top of their voices. I'm very uncomfortable with that. I don't think that is. I don't think we have a right to do that unless you go round and ask people. And I've done that before. And again, it will depend on the culture you're in. But in the culture I was in, it was quite common for a pastor, when he prayed, to pray on behalf of the whole ward, but never without permission. So I would always go around each bed and say, would you mind if I prayed, or would you like me to pray for you? Again, just, you don't want, especially today, maybe people just, they're ready to pounce on Christians, and you know, it can be viewed as proselytizing or, you know, stressing people out. You know, quite easily you have an atheist in the ward. You know, you don't want to give them a heart attack or give them reason to say that, you know, we caused their blood pressure to go up or whatever. So just be very careful. And lastly there, just sometimes you'll feel your visit has had very little spiritual content. You end up talking about the the wound or the surgery or the arthritis or the treatments, and maybe people are very fixated on that and you hardly are able to direct the conversation to anything spiritual. Okay, you pray, you read your Bible with them, but I wouldn't beat yourself up too much over that. You've shown care, you've shown love, you've shown you're interested, and just trust the Lord to bless the little that you've been able to pray or read or say. Yeah, there again, that's 25, number 25, J. Adams. By what short-term goals may one glorify God in the visitation of the sick? And how may he seek to enable sick members of God's flock to do the same? The answer simply is that God may be glorified by the pastor, one, by adequate care that demonstrates the love of Christ, by pastoral care that pleases God even if not acknowledged or appreciated by the sick member. The sick member may be helped to glorify God by being helped to handle his sickness in a manner pleasing to God, by learning to share the implications of sickness with others. It's amazing how good opportunities are provided for you when you're sick in a hospital ward. And you encourage Christians who are sick in hospital wards, obviously not dying sick, but to take opportunities to speak with people and encourage them to glorify God there in the hospital ward. So a couple more comments there on visitation. I think that one in the middle, number 24, book 24, L.B. Glynn. Very wise. Here are some principles I followed in hospital visitation. I never gave medical advice, nor did I probe as to the nature of a person's illness, especially the case when it's a woman. You'll often just be told, sometimes you won't be told if a woman's going into hospital for an operation. And you might find out some months later. Don't get offended by that, and don't start making inquisition. There's a reason you weren't told. And other times you'll be asked to visit a woman in hospital, or you'll come across a woman in hospital who is one of your members. And your first thing is, well, what are you doing here? Well, if you don't know, you're not meant to know. And so don't make inquiry. There's so many female issues that are just really embarrassing, and they just don't want you to know. And it's the same for a man. If you come across a male member in hospital and he didn't tell you, or the family didn't tell you, don't assume you have a right to know. You can still pray with them and just show discretion and wisdom in your conversation with them. Yes, sometimes a member will not want her name in our Sunday bulletin hospital list. He says, though I rarely read from the Bible, almost without exception I prayed, including a verse in my petition. I never asked permission, but quietly said, I'm going to offer a prayer now. Rarely did anyone object. I made it a point to visit mothers and their new babies in the hospital, often the very day of their birth. I also saw people soon after surgery. Personally, I tended not to visit mothers just after. In fact, I didn't visit mothers who had given birth in hospital unless I was specifically asked to do so. And I usually ask the husband, would you want a visit? But quite often the answer would be no. And I think that's perfectly understandable as well. You've got, especially if you're a young man, and here's a young woman, she's in hospital, she's absolutely wrecked after giving birth. She knows she looks terrible. She's wearing her night clothes or whatever, often breastfeeding, and often it's just total chaos, especially if it's a first child. And you can pass on your care and your thoughts by letter, by card, communicate. You'll visit as soon as they feel sane again, which she'll probably be about 10 years later. But just be wise. Yeah, sometimes you'll visit and the person's asleep. Don't wake them up, right? They're asleep for a reason, usually because they've hardly had any. And you might think, man, I've just travelled, 2 hours to get to the hospital, and the person's gone and slept on me. But you have a card with you that you can leave and say you called, and you'll see them the next time you're passing or something like that. And that's, most people, just that's fine. They're usually very glad you didn't wake them up. I like that idea too. Pray with the patient the day before surgery. That's usually in their home today. Most surgeries are done with an early morning admission. Yeah, one minister told me that when he was ill, two ministers visited over an hour, leaving him exhausted and sicker than when they arrived. I know the feeling. Okay, let's move on from that. Encourage the sick with truth and service. Really underlining a couple of the points that Jay Adams made earlier. It's expressed really beautifully here, I think, by Andrew Bonar. Two thoughts he left with God's people in sickness. One was that they might do a great service for the Lord by praying much. And that it is really promotion to be not down in the valley with Joshua, but with Aaron and Hur on the mountaintop. The other thought was that they are teaching angels. Ephesians 3:10. Angels learn much by visiting God's people. They know nothing of suffering themselves, but they learn from the patience and joyfulness of suffering believers. When the sick one enters heaven, some of the angels will say, "Oh, here is my teacher come." Quite remarkable, that, isn't it? A young woman was taken to the hospital incurably ill. Dr. Bonar went to see her and before leaving said to her, "Remember us in prayer." She'd been feeling very sad, and these words were like new life to her. It was not, "We will remember you," but "You will remember us." And she saw there was still work for her to do, though laid on a bed of sickness. Then the elderly, 2:5, the elderly, they should be sought out and treated with great respect and kindness, says Taylor and Plummer. And in that bold section, he says, one of the greatest sorrows of old age flows from neglect, to be buried in forgetfulness before they enter the grave is enough to make them sad. Their hints to young ministers are well worth attention. Their prayers for them often bring them support and success, which they looked not for. And then there's a few practical tips there on dealing with elderly people. Yeah, don't give up on them, even if they're unconverted and very hardened in their sins. It is, deathbed conversions are possible. They really are. I saw two in my own ministry. One, I had definitely given up on the guy. And he was married to a godly woman. He never went to church himself. Whenever I visited, left the house. Or started a big argument, or tried to, and got very sick with cancer. It was just bright yellow with jaundice. One time I visited, I thought it was the last time, and I tried with all my might to engage him in a spiritual conversation, and he almost spat in my face and turned his back to me and face to the wall, and you could just, his body was shriveling by this point. And I remember leaving just in agony, really, for him and his wife. And she was just so embarrassed by it all. And then, 2-3 days later, I didn't even think he'd lived that long, I got a phone call from his wife to say that, "You're not going to believe this, but I think XYZ's been converted." She said, "There's a huge change." the Lord's people came round last night to visit after the prayer meeting, and he wanted them around his bed, and he was talking with them, and they prayed with him, and he was weeping. And I was just as sceptical as you could be. I mean, Dawkins sceptical. And I went, and as soon as I saw him, I knew he'd been converted. As soon as I saw his face, I mean, still as sick as could be, still as yellow as mustard, but his whole face had changed. And he just wept when he saw me, and you know, held out his arms, and pulled me towards his bed, and stayed there for about half an hour with him. And he was talking about the Lord, and what the Lord had done for him, just that 24, 48 hours. Lived for another few days. I had one more conversation with him, his wife had many, people were coming in. And wow, it's just such an incredible transformation. It's just, it can really happen. And so don't give up. It's rare, very, very rare, but don't give up. Despite the difficulty, visit the poor. And here Bonar talks about how he visited the poor with Robert Hamilton once in Edinburgh, and how he was amazed at this pastor's dealings with the poor. And he said, "Find the difficulty of visiting the poor to be less than I thought. Often I have to drag myself to visit the poor. This shows me the great corruption in my heart, how very little love and zeal, how little I dwell in heavenly places." Sometimes it's just a very physical thing. You know, we're used to living in such clean, tidy, fragrant homes. And you enter a poor person's home and you can feel physically sick. I'm sure some of you experienced that. You just feel revolted by the smell, by the dirt, by... And it's very deterring, isn't it? You don't want to go back there. I remember I went to visit somebody once and it was really sickening. I was just retching in my stomach as I was sitting in the chair with the things I was seeing. And I don't know if this is the right thing to do. Maybe it's not. I don't know. But I offered to go back to the house with a friend and my wife to help him clean it up. Is that insulting to somebody? I don't know. But anyway, we did, and oh dear, it was one of the worst experiences of my life. We pulled out the cooker, you know, which was just food splattered everywhere. There was a carpet under the cooker, and it was just full of maggots. It was just writhing in maggots. It's just horrific. And you know, do you want to go back and visit that home again? It's just, I mean, we have to be honest. It's really tough. And yeah, we're called to do it. And the Lord did it. The Lord, what does the Lord see in our life? You know, but maggots and filth. How obnoxious, how stinking we are to him. And yet, he comes and lives in us. He doesn't just come and do a hit and run, tidy up and leave. He stays and scrubs and keeps dealing with the filth we keep bringing back in again. So to me, that's the only way I can do anything. Just keep remembering, you know, what I really am by nature. John? Very grateful, actually. I mean, we went back probably a few months later and things were pretty grim again. Not quite as bad, but he was a schizophrenic as well and had so many problems. You really need somebody like that cared for in sheltered housing or something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Visit the poor and the children. A couple of quotes there, just recommending. Connect with children in the church setting and in homes. You know, you're often tempted when you go and visit a home that you talk with the wife, you talk with the husband, and all the children might be there, but you're really not connecting. So really make an effort when you visit a home to connect with the children and talk with them at their level. You don't really need, I don't think... you know, to get to spiritual things with children all the time. Especially initially, they just up go the walls. If you just, you know, do you love the Lord, or, you know, have you confessed your sin or whatever. I just think you should talk to them about their hobbies, their interests, what they're doing at school, what they like, what they don't like, and just gradually build that relationship. And they're hardly ever going to answer you truthfully in front of their parents anyway. You know, if you start asking them about spiritual things, they'll give you stock answers, but you might be making them lie. So just trust that the Lord will open doors and sort of grease and oil the hinges of these doors by just building friendships with children. The fringe, 2:8. This is it's still a maxim, actually. It says it's visit the. Okay. Visit the fringe. So these are people that sometimes come, sometimes don't. Relatives of people who are connected to the church and so on. And then we get to 2:9. Men should deal with men and women with women. Back to what we were discussing on the message board. And this is from Derek Prime and from R.C. Anderson. I'm going to let you read that yourself.